good evening. It is Tuesday, February 11th, 2020. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, as I just said in the opening, it is Tuesday. That means it's primary day in New Hampshire. They are voting as Democratic presidential hopefuls are seeking momentum. In the wake of Iowa, what can we expect as the polls close in New Hampshire this evening? Well, for insight, we turn to my first guests. First, he's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. As always, Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by a professor of political science at Hamline University and author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Professor David Schultz. As always, David, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
So a Reuters story today opens with, today is the second contest in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination with U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg jostling to remain atop a crowded field after strong performances last week in Iowa, end quote. Jostling to remain atop a crowded field? According to Real Clear Politics, their poll aggregation, Sanders is up 7.4 points, and he's been there for quite a while. Klobuchar and Warren don't even break 12, with Biden at 11. What is this jostling? Help me out, Daniel Lazar.
Well, I think the press is definitely trying to build up Buttigieg as the great white hope, so to speak. I mean, he's the moderate who will stop the Sanders juggernaut. We'll see if that's true, of course. But the press is definitely showing its leanings here.
David, same question to you. I don't see a 7.4 lead that has been around that for days now in New Hampshire. I don't see that as jostling.
It's not jostling. Actually, if anything, if you look at some of the recent polls, Sanders seems to have picked up some steam going into New Hampshire. I mean, his lead, he's had a lead for several weeks, but even post, New Hampshire debate Friday, again, look at some of the polls here. He's actually added to the lead. So there is no sort of jostling there, huh? And again, this is part of, I think, a couple of different things. One of them, as we've consistently have seen with sort of the mainstream corporate media, CNN being, I think, the most notorious, and Washington Post, either not covering Sanders or shaving the facts in ways to make him look in his worst possible way, because I think, as the other guest pointed out, they don't want him, and Buttigieg is now the great white hope, since Biden does appear to be, at least for now, the great white hope that's going to be taking on and vindicating what? Capitalism against that dirty, rotten socialist.
I'm glad you put it that way, because that takes me, Daniel, to the next point. Great white hope until we get to Nevada and Bloomberg has his foot in the water.
Well, we'll see how well Bloomberg does. I mean, I think that you really can't buy an election with money, even $55 billion worth of it. So we'll see how well he really does. I mean, I haven't met a single person, a single person who describes himself as a Bloomberg supporter. So, you just really can't buy public enthusiasm. And Sanders has, there are two people who generate real public enthusiasm in this race. One is Donald Trump, the other is Bernie Sanders. And the rest are just like, or a big blah, as far as I can tell.
This is still somewhat of a crowded field, especially if you watch MSNBC, CNN, and MSNBC. This is still a crowded field. Is this still a good thing in terms of issue articulation, or does this damage the Democratic candidates in the long run, David Schultz?
Okay, first, just one correction. Bloomberg is now worth $61 billion. So,
thank you.
So we're off a few billion dollars on this one. And I think by the time this conversation's over, they'll probably be worth $62 billion or something like that. But on one hand, it does make it difficult for the Democrats to coalesce around a single narrative to beat Donald Trump. because the party is tremendously divided. But I'm going to also take a contrarian position and say that this is a fight for whatever heart and soul there is of the Democratic Party. Is it going to continue to remain a corporate, basically a corporate pro-business party, or are you going to start to see Sanders finally able to pull the party back towards, you know, maybe its original roots, or not original roots, but FDR roots, or maybe some other roots or something. And so I think it cuts both ways. But if you're looking at just the electoral short-term problems right now, it's dividing the party at a point when they need to get a common message.
Daniel, do you think that David is accurate in this? Yes, it is pulling the party, but I see the elitist wing of the party, the Clinton/Obama wing and the Wall Street wing of the party, they're going to fight. They're going to fight Bernie Sanders till the last dog dies.
Oh, yeah. I think it's, well, we'll see what happens tonight. But if Sanders comes through New Hampshire, as you know, with as strong a showing as the polls indicate, then things will get very interesting, because then, you know, Sanders will be the dominant candidate in the race, no question about it. And we'll see what the Democratic establishment does in response. I mean, AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee, is going bonkers, mm-hmm. trying to figure out a way to stop Sanders, you know, in his tracks. And I'm sure others will be following up as well. So we'll see what goes on. But it to get more interesting from here on in rather than less.
And David, I'll come back to you and let you respond to that point, because, again, if the playing field were level and fair, I would agree with you that they're going to basically lick their fingers, see which way the wind is blowing. And if the
right.
wind is blowing in Bernie's way, they go Bernie. But I don't see it fair. I don't see it level. And again, I think the corporate elitist interests, not only of the party, but of the media, are doing everything they're in it to until the last dog dies.
No, I absolutely agree with it, which is why I ultimately think that it's going to be Bloomberg that gets the nomination, even though you're right, I don't know anybody whose first choice is Bloomberg. But I'm going to sketch out another story here, and I'm going to bet you guys a quarter on this, because everybody's going to declare Joe Biden dead after New Hampshire. But then we're going to go to Nevada. We're going to go to South Carolina. He's going to do better there. And the media is going to suddenly declare that Joe Biden is a comeback kid or the next Lazarus. And you're going to see kind of this almost this fairy tale story of Joe coming back, because I think they and the party are going to try to give Biden one last pitch, one last push before they have to basically give up on him. And again, I don't think they're going to coalesce around Buttigieg. I think it's going to wind up eventually where they look at the resources and say, Bloomberg's got $2 to $4 to $5 billion he's going to spend, and the corporate party is going to hold their nose or not so hold their nose, and it's going to be Bloomberg.
Before Daniel responds, David, let me ask you this to that point. The wild card that I see in that statement that you just gave is that Obama isn't backing Biden. Looking mm-hmm. at the Bloomberg commercials that I don't think would have been able to have been produced unless Obama had agreed to it, even with his voiceover in some of the instances, or at least his voice being used.
Right.
I don't see how Biden, especially when, now, the common narrative is Biden's banking on South Carolina, where he enjoyed right. strong support among African-American voters. But I think that support is generational. And mm-hmm. the numbers are telling me that his support in the African-American community in South Carolina, those are old folks. The young kids are going with Bernie. So with those two things, tell me if you think that changes the narrative any. And then Daniel will come to you.
I agree with you on your analysis, but I still think the corporate media.
Right. You're right there.
So I guess we're saying the same thing, but in different ways. The corporate media is going to want to tell the story of what Joe Biden is Lazarus.
Gotcha.
He comes back from the dead.
Okay. Daniel Lazar, your thoughts.
Well, first of all, we'll see how well Biden does in South Carolina. If he does well, then then I think David's scenario makes a great deal of sense, and the press will declare that it's comeback time. But if he continues to fade, which I think is certainly possible, then he'll just be, you know, he'll be out of the running. I mean, Biden is really, really weak on the campaign trail. The guy's, you know, the guy has, his mind is gone. He makes embarrassing verbal, you know, fluff, calling some woman a pony-faced dog soldier. I don't know what the hell.
No, a dog-faced pony soldier. And I'll quickly explain to you what that is.
Okay.
A pony soldier was the reference to cavalry soldiers that fought in the American Indian Wars in the Midwest after the Civil War. A dog face was a derogatory term used to describe Indians, and particularly Indian scouts, who supported those soldiers.
Ooh. Okay.
So,
ooh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Come on, fellas.
We're
high-level intellectuals here. I thought you knew this.
I still have no idea what Biden was driving at.
But he makes
verbal fluff all over the place. His performance of the debates is really, really embarrassing. So maybe he'll pull something off in South Carolina. You know, maybe David is right. Maybe there'll be a comeback time. But maybe, but we'll have to see. And if he keeps on fading, then I assume that Buttigieg will be the favorite candidate of the moderates. And if Buttigieg fades, which is certainly possible, because I thought his performance in the New Hampshire debate was especially weak.
Then David Schultz will be the nominee.
and then maybe a Bloomberg.
Then I leave the country.
Comes.
Okay.
and so maybe a Bloomberg scenario becomes more realistic. But let me just say that if Bloomberg becomes the nominee, it'll tear the party apart. Two-thirds of the party will stay home. The idea of a presidential election being fought out between two billionaires will be so dispiriting, so discouraging, will be such an eloquent statement on the parlous state of American democracy that two-thirds of Democratic Party voters will give up in disgust, and Trump will waltz to a second term.
Here's a comparison or an analogy that I want to draw in South Carolina, again, with the black vote. There are similarities, in my opinion, between that and what happened in Florida for Obama with the Hispanic vote, particularly Cubans. Older Cubans, anti-Castro Cubans, voted Republican. Their kids voted Democrat. And that played a great deal in how Senator Barack Obama won Florida in spite of what Lil Marco was trying to do. And I can see a very similar split generationally happening in South Carolina with the black vote. And Steyer is down there now running ads and I think chipping away at Biden support. David Schultz, your thoughts?
Yeah. Two observations. One is, this is a scary thought, by the way, because I think Steyer, the third billionaire or something like that, or whatever he's worth, and he's at 17% in the polls. I mean, this is pretty remarkable. You're right. So he's chipping away pretty effectively and banking on there. Now, and I think that's probably coming from, I would say, the more centrist part or moderate part of the party, you know, but it's hard to really figure out. Now, your other scenario, again, regarding the older versus the younger, you know, black or African-American voters, again, I wouldn't be surprised if it's correct. But now the difficulty is, are those younger voters actually going to show up to vote? Because they showed up for Obama in 2008, but they didn't show up in 2012. And we certainly know in 2016, they didn't show up for Clinton. So I think that's going to be the interesting question here is to what extent, and this is the challenge that Bernie had 4 years ago, 25,000 young people would show up for a rally, 2,000 would show up to vote. And so he's got to figure out how to make that translation better this time than he did last time.
And let me get out. We only have about a minute left. And let me ask you, Daniel Lazar, about Bloomberg's ads using President Obama in the ads and appealing to the black vote when he now has to answer to his stop and frisk campaign in New York.
Oh yeah, I mean, Bloomberg's that campaign was amazing. It was outrightly racist. It was targeting black and Hispanic young men explicitly, and I don't know. I don't know how he can get around that. And the and the damage that was done to young lives. I mean, guys were found with, you know, with half a joint in their pocket, were sent to jail. They lost their jobs. You know, they got caught up in the criminal justice system. It was really a nightmare. And, you know, this is Bloomberg's policy. So, he's got to be held to account. He should not get a free pass on this.
And we got about 45 seconds. David Schultz, does that say anything to you about Barack Obama understanding the reality of those politics and still backing Bloomberg?
Yeah, no. I mean, it really shows us that one of two things. One, some people say the party has moved further to the left than it was when Obama got elected, or B, which I think is the more of a correct answer, that what? Obama was what? A neoliberal centrist at best. And the difference between him and Clinton was just razor thin in terms of their ideology. And Bloomberg becomes potentially what? The heir to the throne of that neoliberalism.
Daniel Lazar, Professor David Schultz. Gentlemen, thank you both so much. Fantastic analysis, as always. Look forward to having you guys back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg has launched an ad campaign aimed at the African-American electorate, where he poses with former President Barack Obama in various pictures working on solving issues together. Well, how will this play in the African-American community as people remember his staunch defense of the racist stop and frisk campaign in New York? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's an author. He's a political scientist, former chairman of the political science department at Howard University, Dr. Clarence Lussain. As always, Clarence, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's do this. Let's hear the audio of Mike Bloomberg defending his stop and frisk campaign.
They just keep saying, oh, it's a disproportionate percentage of a particular ethnic group. That may be, but it's not a disproportionate percentage of those who witnesses and victims describe as committing the murder. In that case, incidentally, I think we disproportionately stop whites too much and minorities too little.
Dr. Lussain, that is just, I did a lot of research on stop and frisk in New York. The data just does not support that position. Take it from there, Clarence.
No, it does not. And it isn't just stop and frisk, it's stop and harass. And that's what the Black community all over the country and in fact all over the world complains about, this disproportionate policing. And so that certainly resonates in the memories of not only African-Americans in New York who were victimized by this policy, but African-Americans across the country who understand that feeling. And so Bloomberg has a long way to go to repair that particular damage. Now, I would say it's a very complicated political race right now for the Democrats. And as you know, a great emphasis on the Black from the Black community is on who can actually win. And if Biden falters, and there's a good case to be made that not only will that likely happen, but it's happening right now, then a month and a half from now, Bloomberg might actually be in the center of this discussion about support from the Black community.
Isn't that to a great degree by design, in that at the beginning of the race, a lot of people thought that Joe Biden was going to be the nominee? In fact, Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, just as far as what I've been able to research and discern, decided not to enter the race once he found out that Joe Biden was going to get in. And that now that the elites, those in control of the party, are now starting to get the sense that Biden will not be able to carry the day. That's what motivated them to encourage Bloomberg to get in. And that is also why now Mr. Perez has decided to modify the rules in the debate qualifications so to make it easier for Bloomberg to get on the stage.
No, you're absolutely right. There is jitters among the Democratic Party elite and party moderates because their standard bearer is falling. Similar, I think, to what happened with Jeb Bush in 2016, where the Republican establishment basically were behind him until they weren't behind him. And so I think we're seeing a similar case. And underlining all of this is the fear of Bernie and Elizabeth Warren. And so to build up that side of the party, there's not a lot of hope that Buttigieg is actually going to make it through this whole process. Klobuchar is iffy at best. So that doesn't leave a lot. Tom Steyer and some of those others are just too marginalized. Bloomberg has a big name from a big city, and he's got big money. And anybody that's been on social media in the last 3 weeks or television or, you know, basically anything where there's a possibility of an ad, Bloomberg has come through and is paying off in the polls. He's rising in the polls. And as you point out, Perez is basically succumbing to this gruesome reality that Bloomberg has basically bought his way into this discussion.
Let me give another quote from Bloomberg as he's having to answer after audio emerged of him defending this policy. Quote, 95% of murders and murder victims fit one MO. You can just take a description, Xerox it, and pass it out to all the cops. They are male, minorities, 16 to 25. That's true in New York. That's true in virtually every city, and that's where the real crime is. Clarence, you've been studying this for years. You've written on this numerous times. This is profiling. This is so egregious that a simple apology that he gave, in my mind, doesn't address this in any way, shape, or form.
Well, this is what you say when you have no concern about the black voter. If you're not thinking of running for president, you're not running for mayor, or you think you don't need the black vote, this is the kind of stuff you say.
Hold on a minute there, Dr. Lussain. It's deeper than that, because this is not just what you say. These are the policies that, as a person in charge, you implement.
Yep. Well, these policies were in place. Bloomberg extended them and then justified them.
Because it was Mayor Rudy that put this stuff in place.
It was Mayor Rudy that did it. And, you know, pushing back against, you know, the mayor before him, the black mayor that had existed prior to Rudy coming in. So what you get now then is Bloomberg realizing, as he tries, as you point out, an apology tour of sorts, that this is pretty toxic. And, you know, these are some pretty deadly statements on a policy that, again, disrupted the black community for years. And so, you know, there's a lot of makeup that Bloomberg would have to go through. And for clearly some in the black community, they're not going to get past this because it, for many people, is believed to reflect a commitment on the part of Bloomberg to not dealing with racial justice. But again, I suspect if Biden falls out of the race and the other moderates don't seem to have the capability to go far, then Bloomberg's strategy, backed by, as you point out, an elite of the party, he could, again, very well be competitive. Because I think this really is about stop Bernie Sanders. And, you know, to a lesser degree, stop Elizabeth Warren, because, you know, the party, you know, at least the party elite, not only fear that they can't win, but that they will be enacting policies that the party has resisted for decades.
Two things. One, this is anecdotal, but a number of years ago, I was on a couple of panels in New York dealing with this stop and frisk issue. And I very clearly remember a gentleman by the name of Rudy, I won't mention his last name, who lived in one of the areas that was being targeted by this policy, stood up and told the audience that every day his son, who walked to high school, was stopped by the police on his way home, put up against the wall, and more than once taken down to the precinct where Rudy had to go get his son out of jail. And Rudy went to the commander of the precinct and asked him, man, why do you continue to harass my son? He's an A student. He's doing everything right. And the commander told Rudy, if you don't want this to continue to happen to your son, I strongly suggest you move out of the neighborhood. Now, that's anecdotal. That's anecdotal. But I do remember the data. 85% of the stops on drugs were people of color. And those stops did not result in any more confiscation of narcotics than in any other white neighborhoods in New York. To your point, they were just harassing people of color.
Yep. I worked on this issue when I lived in London for a couple of years, and this was a key issue. Same exact thing. Way, way disproportionate harassment, stopping, frisking people of color, and particularly people of African descent. And so Bloomberg has to, which he has not done, really acknowledge not just that the policy was wrong, but that underneath this policy is a racism in this country that has to be confronted. And that hasn't come out of Bloomberg's mouth yet, as far as I can tell. But what we're witnessing is, and you know, I want to hear your opinion on this too, a number of black mayors,
yep,
and I suspect there will be others,
yep,
are already starting to endorse Bloomberg.
And many of those black mayors, the one in Washington, Muriel Bowser, sent members of her staff up to Rudy's mayoral think tank to learn how to organize their offices and learn. So Bloomberg has been deeply, deeply involved. And these are the neoliberal policies. This is what I think we're getting the crux. A lot of these mayors are pro-gentrification individuals. They are implementing neoliberal policies. And I'll say this and then get your take on this. If the Democrats continue to back Bloomberg as they are, they're making the same mistake with him in 2020 that they made with Hillary in 2016. It's going to depress the turnout of the African-American community. And then in 2022, we're going to have people like Reverend Sharpton coming on television saying the reason that we're stuck with four more years of Donald Trump is because black people didn't turn out to vote. CBC's backed him as well. Go ahead.
So you're absolutely right. So Bloomberg was very active in the National Mayors Association,
mm-hmm,
whatever that thing is called. And so he knows a lot of these people individually, and they identify with him because, he basically has articulated these policies that you're talking about. And these mayors are all under fire in their cities from black communities that are being displaced. And so, you know, he has not addressed that, just as these mayors have not. So I think you're right that, you know, the direction that they're heading in is setting it up for a very Hillary Clinton-like implosion. But I think they're thinking it would be a more Barack Obama kind of deal. Because, you know, Barack Obama was basically neoliberal and moderate. And they're hoping that that will be a more unifying element than what they're going to get from what they fear from Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. But this really is about, you know, Biden not being able to carry the weight that they expected. He's going to probably do poorly in New Hampshire. There's no guarantee, I think, that he actually is going to do all that great in South Carolina.
Nope.
So, you know, he's counting on the black vote, but, you know, that's...
He's been leaking oil there.
Yep. And then in Nevada, you know, there's no guarantees. So you know, again, in a month and a half from now, Biden might be out of the discussion. And then, you know, we've got a whole new game. And Bloomberg, there is no question his money is having an impact. You know, he has spent more than all of them collectively getting ads out. Now, Perez, I think you're right, has been disingenuous. And, you know, they didn't change the rules when you had, you know, black candidates in the race who were clearly being disadvantaged by having New Hampshire and Iowa as the top, you know, as the first contest where you have to spend millions and millions. And the fact that, you know, it's a black candidate, you could not raise the kind of funds. And then they're going to change the rules of the game. So Perez should really be taking the task for that. And the consequences of it is that, you know, what should have been an easy victory against Trump is shaping up into, you know, a much more difficult one.
Now, two things. One, as we talk about Tom Perez and the machinations that he's involved in, we have to understand, I think, the pressures that are put upon him by the Clinton wing, Clinton slash Obama wing of the party to do these things. When you go back and look at one of the things I have found very interesting about Bloomberg's commercials, from the very first commercial, he was always running against Donald Trump. He was always running those commercial ads, always focused on the general election, never focused on the primary process. And could the Democrats, and I made this point before, but I want to put it in this context, by having Barack Obama backing Bloomberg, which those ads to me seem to be that's the way this is going to play out, is Bloomberg making the same mistake with Obama that Hillary Clinton made? Hillary Clinton thought in 2016 that rolling President Obama out at the end would galvanize and rally the black masses to her campaign, and that did not happen. Is Bloomberg potentially making the same mistake?
Yeah, I have serious doubts about how mobilizable Barack Obama could actually be at this juncture, particularly with young voters who were basically kids. And they sort of like, yeah, we had the first black president, but it doesn't have the same kind of cachet that, you know, it had for like older black people.
I still have amazing student debt I have to pay.
Yeah.
In spite of a black president, I still have amazing student debt I have to pay.
Or because it was a black president. But in any case,
there you go.
You know, so, you know, who Bloomberg would, you know, convince kind of along those lines among young people. So then, you know, the other issues that started to come in, Stacey Adams, you know, and
Abrams.
You know, is anybody going to get Abrams something?
Right.
You know, is anyone going to get her on the ticket, you know, which would be potentially a game changer? Short of that, then, you know, I can't imagine who, you know, Biden wins, who he would have on his ticket, or Bloomberg for that matter. So, you know, there's a lot up in the air.
I could see, it wouldn't surprise me, let me put it this way, it would not surprise me if you have a Bernie Ocasio-Cortez ticket or a Bernie Stacey Abrams ticket, since both of those women come out of the Bernie camp.
Yeah, so Abrams would, I think, be a better, you know, better choice. I just think AOC is just not, you know, she's not going to put older black folks, right? And then, you know, that ticket would, you know, be seen as, by a lot of folks, as extreme left.
Yeah, and AOC is much more toxic than Stacey Abrams. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
But I was just looking at progressive females that have the national cachet that come out of the Bernie camp.
And is she even old enough to be on the ticket?
That's a good
think about it.
That's a good question. That's a good question. You know, I don't know.
But in any case, I think, you know, right, the mix gets, you know, gets really kind
right.
of complicated.
Right.
So, you know, but I think, you know, the issue of Bloomberg and the black community will become increasingly important if Biden falls.
AOC is 30 years old, so she's not old enough to be president.
Yes, so she's not. Yes, so I think so.
Okay.
So Bloomberg then has, you know, to address this pretty quickly, because if he's going to be on the next debate, this is going to be the issue that I would suspect would come up pretty sharply. You know, Bernie should raise it. Biden absolutely will raise it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he's going to have to come up with a way to not apologize, but, you know, explain and demonstrate, you know, he has some understanding of the real harm and negativity of what those policies were. I think if he can't do that, then he's going to be like Buttigieg, who, you know, has not given any satisfactory answer, as far as I'm concerned, on his tenure as mayor and, you know, what he did with policing in his city.
Final question, and then I'll get out here. So let's say that Bernie, Biden, and Bloomberg are on the stage together. How does Biden bring up stop and frisk when Bloomberg's response would be, I'll see your stop and frisk and raise you the crime bill?
The crime bill, yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. So Biden, yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. So Biden, you know, does not, you know, he's got some treacherous territory to cross, but basically that's his wall of fire.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't see the other way around it for Biden other than to, you know, try to tear Bloomberg down on that and hope Bloomberg forgot about the crime bill.
Somehow I doubt that.
I doubt it too.
Let me get out of here. Dr. Clarence Lussain, man, thank you so much for your time. I know you got to get to class. Really appreciate it and look forward to having you back.
Thank you, man.
All right. All right, folks. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. MSNBC's Chuck Todd is under fire for reciting a quote comparing Senator Bernie Sanders supporters to Nazis. This after Chris Matthews from MSNBC, his wild rant connects a Bernie Sanders win with public executions. My question is, has hyperbolic rhetoric replaced journalism? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest, a true journalist, former Washington Post bureau chief and two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist with more than 20 years of journalistic experience, award-winning foreign correspondent on two continents, and an author, John Jeter. As always, John, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Always a pleasure, my brother.
So, MSNBC anchor Chuck Todd, he approvingly quotes a right-wing columnist who described online supporters of Senator Sanders, who's vying to become the first Jewish president in U.S. history, as, quote, a digital brown shirt brigade. He said, hey, I want to bring up something that Jonathan Last put up in the Bulwark today. It was about how, and Ruth, we've all been on the receiving end of the Bernie online brigade. Here's what he says. He says, no other candidate has anything like this short of digital brown shirt brigade. I mean, except for Trump. Now, John, this has put people in the Twitterverse in an uproar. Your thoughts?
Oh, boy, I have so many. You know, first of all, I think Chuck Todd should lose his job. I think this is so irresponsible as to be reckless and even demagogic, correct? Secondly, and this is really the big takeaway, and this is not a new thought, but this really represents the death of journalism, which has never, let's be honest, has never been good as an institution in the United States. And you can argue that its true purpose has been to foment class warfare racial warfare to prevent class warfare and sometimes even violent clashes to prevent class warfare. But this really represents sort of this. Think about what Chuck Todd did and said there. He wasn't talking about Bernie Sanders as the president of the United States, 330 million people who, just as one big example, want single-payer health care or Medicare for all, right? This is not a concern for Chuck Todd. He's talking about Bernie Sanders as an existential threat to his privilege. So in that respect, Bernie Sanders does represent a brown shirt, but it's silly. You're talking about, you know, the top 1%. You're talking about a politician who is, I think, the number one or number two most popular politician in the country right now, and one who is clearly building, whether you agree or don't agree with him, clearly is building a movement, grassroots base. This is democracy. And yet Chuck Todd's response is that this is fascism. It's ridiculous.
This is the latest example of what I would call hyperbolic opinion masquerading as journalism. Am I off? Am I being hyperbolic here?
Not at all. I think this is, I won't go too in depth on this, but, you know, like most things in this country that we're seeing today, it's really rooted in the media and the political class's response to the Black Power movement in the late 60s and the early 70s. And if you were, well, you won't recall, but some people might recall that particularly after the death of Fred Hampton in Chicago, the Illinois chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panthers, 6 months later, there was published in New York Magazine this transformative article by the late Tom Wolfe, who wrote the famous story, the iconic story, which was the harbinger of new journalism, Party at Lenny's, I think it was, which is about a fundraiser for the Black Panthers at Leonard Bernstein's, you know, Upper East Side townhome, very luxurious setting, all these white, very wealthy people, and these Black Panthers who are raising money. And the piece goes on very artfully. I will give Tom Wolfe that. He was a hell of a writer. He goes on to basically talk about how ludicrous it was for these liberals, these white liberals, to support these Black revolutionaries. And he has this line where he says, you know, it's just delicious, the thought of, you know, us and them, right? It's like two magnets that you're trying to push together, and they won't. And, you know, they're trying to push these two magnets together, these white liberals, and they can't do it. And what this was, it was a panic. It was a panic that white people were starting to support the Black Power movement, and that this represented an existential threat to Tom Wolfe's privilege and the people who govern the country, the ruling class, our pharaohs. This represented an existential threat. This is what Chuck Todd is articulating, right? He's in a panic because once again we see Bernie Sanders, and I don't care what the polls say, you can take the eye test and see he's very popular with Blacks and Latinos and young people. And Bernie Sanders represents an existential threat to the privilege of people like Chuck Todd. It's a panic. And so they use this overheated language because they're in a panic, right? It's no more to it than that.
And it's interesting that you draw the Fred Hampton comparison, Chairman Fred of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party for self-defense, because what Fred Hampton was doing in Chicago was building a coalition between the Young Lords, which was a Puerto Rican gang, the White Patriots, which was a poor white group in Chicago, and they were coming together to fight against police brutality and fight for fair housing in Chicago. And that's what the FBI and the police in Chicago found to be the existential threat.
Look, you will never hear it in the media. It is not part of the discussion. But if I know one thing, I am 55 years old. I'm a Black man in America. If I know one thing about my country, it is this. The elites, the people who govern this country, the people who own this country, vastly prefer a race war to a class war. They don't want no parts of a class war. And so that's why we have this constant drumbeat and this abdication of journalistic principles. Journalism is a reporter going out asking ordinary people questions about the world they live in, what they want, what is their strategy, what's their plan, who's their favorite candidate. What Chuck Todd is doing is telling you, the average person, what you should think. It's the complete opposite. Why do they do this? Because they would prefer a race war to a class war, or even a gender war to a class war. But they want no parts of Black people and white people and brown people getting together and forming this existential threat to the privileges and the enfranchisement of the very rich.
This narrative that Chuck is promoting, the narrative has been for quite a while that Fox is the biased network. But we've been seeing for quite a while that MSNBC and the others can be, especially MSNBC, can be just as bad on the left as Fox has been on the right. Based upon your time at the Washington Post, what's your perspective on this? Is this a change in American media? Because this makes me think about Edward Bernays, the Austrian-American pioneer in the field of public relations and propaganda, who originated or developed the whole idea of using news as propaganda to sway public opinion. And for those who don't know, Bernays was the double nephew of Viennese psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud. So is this because of technology, American media's bias on steroids, or is this what journalism in America has always been?
There has always been this element of it. I remind people, and of course, you know, this is, you know, I think in some ways you can conflate entertainment media with news media. But if you recall the Red Summer of 1919, well, that's 4 years after Birth of a Nation. And you have to understand, of course, that the newspapers, the dominant media at the time, were parroting this narrative put out by Birth of a Nation, espoused by Birth of a Nation. What we see, I think really the Post is very central to this narrative, the Post over the last 50 years. But you see two things. One is that that panic that occurred almost abruptly after the death of Fred Hampton, the rise of this Black Power movement, which really shook the foundations of the ruling class in the United States. But then you saw, about 5 years later, 1975, you saw the printers, the pressmen strike, right, at the Washington Post, where basically Katharine Graham fired the striking pressmen, right, and replaced them with scabs, which became what? A template for, number one, Ronald Reagan's treatment of the air traffic controllers, but also a template for the modern American economy, right, in the post-industrial phase. But it also speaks to, if you twin those two events, the moral panic that sort of happened after the death of Fred Hampton, and you twin it with the Katharine Graham's treatment of striking workers, which was what? A response to her investors to let them know, look, we're going to make as much money for you as we can. This is our power move. And this is we're going to work together and we're going to rebuild this country and our enterprise to repel this working class movement, which was mostly white. They used that, right, that the printers, the pressmen were mostly white. And we're going to use that to sort of reconsolidate our strength. But if you twin those two events, what happened in 1988? Jesse Jackson, who did what? What was Jesse Jackson's crime in the eyes of the Democratic Party? Why did they then form the moderate DLC, Democratic Leadership Council? Well, Jesse Jackson, much like Bernie Sanders is today, was turning on people mm-hmm. who were turned off to politics. He was drawing people in who had no interest in politics because he was speaking to their needs.
He was expanding the base.
Exact, and they don't want an expanded base because they can control a small base when they know that certain people are going to stay home. They can control that. They don't want this. This is what's the I guess I can't say it on your program, but the line and do the right thing. You know, when Bugging Out wanted to boycott Sal's,
right?
You know,
right.
And Spike Lee said, "Well, you're messing up my con, right?" Right. Well, this is what the elites think of an expanded democracy, of a democratization of the political process. They don't want that. And so if you see the three of these sort of strains coming together, it's like the protagonist in a Hemingway short story, I think. How did you go broke? Gradually and then suddenly. Well, how did the media become so corrupted? Gradually and then suddenly. And we see this sort of climax with Chuck Todd in this sort of moral panic representing what? His partners, his allies in this class warfare, the elites, the wealthy, the investors who already have health care. They don't care anything about Medicare for All. So we really see it's almost a perfect storm is what it is. And it's I tell people this all the time. American history is cyclical, but it's not static, right?
Mm-hmm.
Changes are happening. I can't tell you when they're going to get here, but there's changes happening, and that's what Chuck Todd's responding to because he does not want that change.
And to your point about Reverend Jackson, you would not have President Barack Obama if it weren't for the two runs of Jesse Jackson, particularly because in the last run, what Jackson was able to negotiate to exit the race was what? The reallocation the proportional allocation of delegates. And that's what allowed Barack Obama to stay in the race. A lot of folks don't remember that. So that we can be an equal opportunity attacker. It's not only Chuck Todd, it's Chris Matthews.
Oh, my God.
His fear of socialism sparked this unbelievable post-debate rant about Bernie Sanders' presidency, where he suggested that Sanders might have cheered socialist-led executions in Central Park during the Cold War. Quote, "I have my own views on the word socialist, and I'd be glad to share them with you in private. They go back to the early 50s. I have an attitude about them. I remember the Cold War. I have an attitude towards Castro. I believe if Castro and the Reds had won the Cold War, there would have been executions in Central Park, and I may have been one of those getting executed, and certain other people would be there cheering. Okay?"
One can only hope.
Go ahead. Man, that is just idiotic and irresponsible.
It's extraordinary.
It's also historically wrong.
It's historically inaccurate. And actually, it's even worse than that. It represents a depraved indifference to the people who did suffer those kinds of executions. I'm sure Guatemalans would say, well, you know, we went through it. Why couldn't you go through it, right?
And America, you're the ones that underwrote the whole thing.
Exactly. I'm sure that, you know, Castro certainly executed the enemies of the state, but they were executing people before Castro came to office. Batista was guilty of how many war crimes? Was Batista guilty of how many women were put out in the streets as prostitutes for wealthy white mafioso?
And who supported Batista? Tourists.
Exactly,
the United States.
So Chris Matthews again, he's speaking for his class. I might have been put to death in Central Park. Well, what about the Guatemalans? 300,000, I believe. What about the Nicaraguans? What about the Salvadorans? What about the Argentines? You know, and there's no, we can't even.
What about the Iranians?
So many.
Right.
The Palestinians. We can't even have a debate about these things.
Now, again, because I don't want to be sexist here, I got to give Joyanne Reed her props. She brings a quack body language expert on to assess whether Bernie Sanders was telling the truth in his issue with when Elizabeth Warren came at him and asked him if he had called her a liar. First of all, I think Bernie's lying. This woman, Jeannie Driver, who's a self-styled expert in body language, she says his shoulders come up like a little kid getting caught. He was trying to hide in plain sight. He starts his answer with, well, and we know liars like to start with, well. That's on one of the leading news programs in this country.
And I think it's important to note that inherent in this shift to new journalism that began in the late 60s, the early 70s, really, there has been this, not just the promotion of sort of centering the journalist qua pundit, right? Mm-hmm. Not reporting, but basically waxing philosophical on your views. Think about what Chris Matthews and Chuck Todd are doing. Waxing political on your views, not interviewing people, asking them what they think. It's this authoritarian, you know, almost like a dictator, like a despot. Here's what I think. And suggesting, of course, you should think this too. But think about this also. Joy Reid on MSNBC, I can't even imagine how much money they're breaking her off. I know it's not nearly as much as Rachel Maddow, but she, you know, I'm sure she's within the 1%. Maybe not the top one-tenth of 1%, but in the 1%. But think about the black voices now, as opposed to the black voices we might have seen in 1970 on television. The black voices who reflected a working class, radical many times, black polity.
Ed Bradley.
Labor unions. Ed Bradley. Gil Noble. Think about Gil Noble, right, from New York.
His
journalism. Right. Tony Brown, right? Mm-hmm. And Tony Brown was more conservative, but still, he talked about issues that affected the black community. Joy Reid paid more probably than all those people combined on MSNBC. And there's another guy at MSNBC I've seen a few times, Jason Johnson, I think it is.
Jason Johnson.
I mean, who basically compares Bernie Sanders, who certainly has more money than me, right? But he compares Bernie Sanders to Mike Bloomberg. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous, right?
And got his shorts all in a bunch when Nina Turner called Bloomberg a oligarch.
Oligarch. That's right. That's
He's
right.
He's the ninth wealthiest man in the world.
Exactly. And he is the definition of an oligarch, right? I mean, that's indisputable. I mean, that's just language. That's not a political viewpoint. That's just language, right? And so we've got you know, with this sort of rise, people like Chuck Todd and Chris Matthews, we've also got this sort of black Vichy class of journalists, right? Where most, and I'm tempted to say all, but I'll say most of them that you see with the microphone pushed in front of them, Bakari Sellers, right?
Right.
You know, these people who basically represent the neoliberal, a clearly failed neoliberal project, and they're going to go down with the ship. You know, and that's what they're paid to do. That's what they're paid to do.
And let me get out and let me just say, the fact that Mike Bloomberg is the ninth wealthiest man in the world does not in and of itself make him an oligarch. What makes him an oligarch is the manner in which he is using his financial resources to basically buy the election.
Yes, yes, yes.
And get the rules changed in the process.
And I might add this. I don't know if you could find a better example of a modern day pharaoh than Mike Bloomberg and his rule of New York City, in which he argued that during a stop and frisk operation,
correct,
that characterized his term in office, his terms in office, he argued that this operation, which I think was 94% black and Latino men, were stopped.
Hang on, we have that clip. Let's go ahead, because we talked about it earlier. Let's go ahead and quickly play that clip. Then we got to get out.
Okay.
They just keep saying, oh, it's a disproportionate percentage of a particular ethnic group. That may be, but it's not a disproportionate percentage of those who witnesses and victims describe as committing the murder. In that case, incidentally, I think we disproportionately stop whites too much and minorities too little.
Let's leave it there. I got to get out.
If that ain't an oligarch, I don't know what is.
John Jeter, as always, man, thank you for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.